Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Abrams versus Jones.
May it please the court. Under the Albertson case, this court is required and does think about the effect of construction of a statute. Not only the effect that that statute is going to have on the litigant, it also, of course, the effect that the statutory construction is going to have for the state of Texas and its citizens. I want to talk to you today about the construction of Section 611.0045F, a copy of which is in front of everyone, and a board of which has been made. As the Court of Appeals has construed this statute, we have changed it from a statute designed to protect the rights of mental health patients, all mental health patients, to an automatic turnover statute. Because if the construction of the Court of Appeals is upheld by this court, the only thing that any person would have to do, any parent particularly, is just walk in to the psychiatrist, the mental health professional's office, say, "I want the records."
Let me ask you about that. Assuming it's your position that it shouldn't matter under the statute whether a parent is a divorced parent or not, and let's talk about a parent who is married to the child's other parent, so we're not talking about a divorced parent here. Assuming the parent asks the child psychologist for the records and the psychologist says no, you say that the procedure under the statute is for the parent then to choose a second mental health professional and ask them to give, in essence, a second opinion.
Well, yes, Judge, that's what the statute says. The statute says that you may...
What if that second mental health professional says, no, I don't think you should be entitled to your child's records? Is there any method of appeal or review of that in the statutory scheme?
Yes, Judge. Under the scheme is set out, you go and get another opinion, and if you're not satisfied with that, you go to district court. And under district court, you ask a judge to award you to look at those records.
Where does the statute say that you, after you get the second opinion, you go into district court?
Well, Judge, it says, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact, it's in 611. But the significant thing about that statute is that if the person who is aggrieved chooses to do that, the burden of proof is not upon the person going to court. The burden of proof is upon the mental health professional who is trying to not give up the records. So I think the legislature has set up a relatively easy, as these things go, statutory scheme for a parent to be able to have redress.
In fact, you say in your brief that if Mr. Jones had offered Dr. Abrams any legitimate evidence that he was acting in his parental capacity and was concerned about Chris's care, protection, or emotional health, parties probably would not be before this court.
Judge, I think that's correct.
So that all he has to say is, I'm very troubled about my daughter, and please tell me, please show me these records so I can...
Well, in all of these instances, what we're talking about is the statutory intent. The intent is to give the mental health professional discretion. The legislature has chosen to do that, and this is the same type of situation. If Dr. Abrams had felt that Mr. Jones was acting on behalf of Carissa, asking about Carissa's mental health, asking about her situation, instead of trying to get records for a custody case, I'm sure we would not be here today.
But then does he still have discretion, even after hearing from the parent, deny access if the requirements of Section 611.0045B are met?
Yes, he does, and then we're back to the remedy we just talked about. That is, you go and seek another opinion, or you go into a district court and you seek injunctive relief and appropriate remedies.
So your argument primarily hinges then on subsection B and the discretion that lies with the professional.
Absolutely.
All right. Then, as opposed to hinging primarily on the patient's behalf language in subsection F.
No, they're both independently important.
All right. Because what does on the patient's behalf mean in section F?
In my opinion, Judge, that there's no case law on it, but in my opinion, it means that you must show some demonstrable interest in or reason for getting the records.
And using accepted methods of statutory interpretation, how would you ask us to attach that meaning to that language?
I would say that there has to be some demonstrable proof to the mental health professional that you are acting on behalf of the patient. And that's a discretionary.
But couldn't on the patient's behalf, though, mean the same thing as 611.004A4 in terms of a parent acting on behalf of the minor or in terms of someone asking on behalf of someone who's incompetent without attaching a qualitative aspect to it?
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay, and my question is, what are we supposed to hang our hat on in agreeing with you as to your interpretation?
What you should hang your hat on is the legislative intent. The intent of this, a whole section of 611, was to protect the confidentiality of mental health records.
Where do we find that legislative intent?
Judge, there I have filed a brief, a post-submission brief, which is part of this record, in which that legislative intent is put in there.
And it goes specifically to the interpretation of that on the patient's behalf language?
No, it's a general, you know, legislative intent.
But even if we don't agree with you as to that, does your client still prevail as a result of the discretionary language that is contained in subpart B?
Yes.
Aren't you equating on the patient's behalf within the patient's best interest?
Judge, I think it's similar. I think that examples that we can use, there have got to be situations where parents should not have records.
Well, but the legislature clearly knows how to articulate in the patient's best interest. They've done that throughout the family. And they chose not to use that terminology and simply stated on the patient's behalf. So isn't that an indication that they're not really in that language looking at what's in the best interest of the child and looking at subjective motivation as opposed to, as Justice Hankinson directed, the language in Section 611?
Judge, I think that's correct, and I think it's correct to the extent that what they're doing here, the whole statutory scheme here, is to give the people that the state of Texas has licensed and trained, that's mental health professionals, discretion as to when and when not to turn over the records. And I think that is a determination that has to be made by the mental health professional, and if he determines that the person is not acting in the best interest, then I think he can withhold the record.
But if there was that discretion, they would not have used the word shall in subpart F.
But, yeah, and the difference between the two, 611.004A, and this court has already held, is a discretionary statute. What 045 says is, you don't have discretion to turn over the records unless this situation exists. And in this case, it's our position that there was no action on behalf of the patient. They have to be read together.
Why doesn't the family code give this decision to the district court?
Because the family, there's a couple of different reasons that it would be bad public policy, Judge. One is the fact that we are creating two classes of people. A parent who happens to have been divorced or named as a conservator has a remedy under 157, whereas a parent who has not been divorced only has one remedy, and that's under 611. We're creating two classes of people. Furthermore, we have submitted with our post-submission brief to the appellate court the legislative intent. The legislative intent of that statute was clearly to equalize the rights between parents. We had managing conservatives had one set of rights, possessory conservatives had another set of rights, and joint managing conservatives had another set of rights. And if you read in the legislative intent, the comment from Judge Bill Morris of Houston, he said, we are trying to equalize conservators' rights as to the things enumerated therein.
And so I'll be clear on this. Your argument is that under these statutes, the mental health provider has the absolute right to decide whether a parent should get the access to the records or not.
Judge, when I always hesitate to use the words like absolute right. I think under the statute that the mental health professional has not only the duty and the obligation, but the responsibility to his patient, in this case a minor, to use his discretion to say whether or not those records are going to be harmful to the patient.
Mr. Beck, what about a question? I guess I'm a little bit concerned about a parent trying to child. We have a doctor who told how to guard against.
Well, we go to district court under 611, and we ask for injunctive relief and any other relief available. I think if the doctor is acting arbitrarily, then I think that the district court can not only issue injunctions, I'm sure they could issue attorney's fees, they could issue anything they want to. It's a pretty broad statute. It gives the district court power. We're giving the ultimate protection against arbitrariness to a district court.
What would it look like?
In fact, there's an action for damages against the aggrieved party. The aggrieved party can sue for damages if, in fact, it's arbitrary.
That's correct. And I think that's not a situation that's going to happen very often. For the most part, when parents and mental health professionals talk, they want to cooperate. They want to be cooperative for the children.
What would be the minimum that a parent would have to demonstrate, show or say to the doctor and get the information about the
child? Well, now, Judge, there's a very important distinction here, and it's important that the court understand this, because there's a difference between access to records and access to information. In this case, Dr. Abrams gave both parents information about this child. And that's exactly, it's kind of a situation when you have a horrible situation where a child has been sexually abused, let's say. And the parents then come in and they talk to the psychiatrist and he says, I just don't think it's in that child's best interest that I release these records to you with all these details in them. But let's talk about what we can do to help this child. And in this case, this is what Dr. Abrams did. He gave the parents information. He just had promised this child, and in order to get his confidentiality relationship, he just promised her that he would not reveal this stuff to the parents, and he did it in good faith, believing that the statute allowed him to do it.
Is it your position we should be, or that we are under the provision that allows a parent to go to district court?
Oh no, they could have gone to district court. This is an unusual situation because Judge Montgomery is a family district court judge in Harris County, and he chose to, there's an order entered where he said that he has jurisdiction under 157. When we went to court, I made vigorous objection to being under 157. Mr. Jones never pled anything under 611, and I had a continuing objection to that. And it made a big difference because, you see, if I'm in court on 611, I have the burden of proof. But because the judge chose to think he could hear it under 157 or 611, they put the burden of proof on Mr. Jones' lawyer.
You said or 611. The district court was proceeding under both?
The judge, and if you read the transcript, the first page, he says, well, I have the power to proceed under 157 or 611. And I said, Judge, there's no pleadings, and I object to it. And he said, well, I'll give you a continuing objection, and then we went on with the hearing.
But did you offer any proof that would meet the requirements of 611.005?
I offered very specific proof in there. I put Dr. Abrams on the stand, and he said that there has been no interest articulated by Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones was on the stand, and he never articulated any reason for the records other than the fact that he was the father and he wanted the record.
Isn't that then shifting the burden? He didn't put on any evidence? Doesn't the statute require you to put on evidence?
Well, if you're having a hearing under that statute and the judge is aware of it, yes, it does. And I, in the abundance of precaution, met my burden of proof by putting Dr. Abrams on and having him explain why it was not in the child's best interest to reveal the records.
Let me ask you a question. Let's forget about the parent-child relationship, and let's just talk about the person who's been appointed as a guardian for incompetence of the patient. And the doctor can choose not to release the information to the patient because it might be harmful to the patient's physical, mental, and emotional health.
Right, which is what the statute says.
But the court has appointed a guardian whose sole job is to protect, guardian of the person, to protect that person. And there's subsection F. It says the content of confidential records shall be made available to a person listed, which is a guardian. Is it your statement that the who is acting on the patient's behalf is an additional threshold that the guardian has to do before the guardian gets access to that patient
information? I think anyone listed in that statute has that additional burden, but I think it's a rather academic one in that case.
But the court has already determined that this is the person whose care, custody, and control and is to be placed in their possession. It's already a court determination. You're saying F says, in addition to that, the guardian has to go back to the court and get another decision on whether or not the guardian should have access to the patient's records.
And the reason for that is if you go along with the Court of Appeals, then you have to buy into the proposition that parents always act in the best interest of their child.
But the statute doesn't.
I understand that, but I'm saying that's what the assumption of the appellate court is, that's what the argument of respondent is, and we know there's situations where that doesn't exist.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Please, court.
Mr. Brown, can we presume for purposes of this case that the information that's in dispute is or will be detrimental to the minor's emotional well-being? Well, why can't we? Because there's a second opinion option. There's an option to go to court. It doesn't really matter to your argument that it could be detrimental to the child's emotional well-being. You're relying on a strict construction of the statute that presumes, even if it is detrimental, it's nevertheless producible. Do you understand my question?
Yes, ma'am, and I answer it this way. We know that it's not detrimental. Because a district judge in the state of Texas, after reviewing the documents in camera, found that they should be released to Mr. Jones.
But, again, let's presume that the information is detrimental for purposes of argument. That would not matter for your argument, because under your argument, it's a strict turnover statute for parents.
No. I believe that if there is language that is truly detrimental, then under 611, a mental health care professional may go to a district court in the state of Texas and say, Judge, this is why you ought not let anybody, any parent, anybody else, see these records.
And is that what happened here?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, because when we asked the records to be brought down, when we filed our motion to obtain the records, counsel brought the records, Dr. Ravens brought the records to the court, Judge Montgomery took them, made an in-camera inspection, and then ordered that the records be turned over to Mr. Jones after that inspection had been made.
So you would disagree then with the Court of Appeals' strict statutory construction analysis that it's an automatic turnover statute?
Yes, ma'am.
Does a parent always back to the child's?
Unless there is a written finding under Texas Family Code Section 153.072 that the parent that limits the parental rights, I think there is a presumption that a parent is acting in his child's interest.
I guess I'm just curious. Is there a conceivable way that a parent could be asking for this information and not be acting?
Well, I can conceive of ways where the parent would not be acting in the child's best interest if the child.
Then why shouldn't we resolve that question?
I think it's worthwhile to resolve that question. I think this case resolves that because here, Justice, there was an in-camera inspection by a Texas district judge.
Counsel, is this a slightly different argument than you made to the Court of Appeals and that you've made in your briefs in this court?
That's correct.
You've changed your position now and are not in disagreement with your opponent about interpreting the statute. And you're just saying on this record, your client's entitled to the records.
No, Justice. The reason there's a slightly different approach is I didn't have these questions asked at the lower appellate court.
So we understand your position. Do you now agree with your opponent about interpreting the statute, that there are circumstances in which a parent could be asking for records and it would not be on the patient's behalf?
I've always agreed with that.
All right, and that, in fact, the provision in subpart B that gives discretion to the mental health professional, in fact, is determinative of whether or not the records are turned over.
Yes, but here's
okay, and that what your position is then, in this case, then, what happened was you had a proceeding in the trial court, and, in fact, the trial court determined
that it was not detrimental and therefore the record should be turned over. Is that where you are today?
That's one of the places I am today.
Well, where else are you?
It is my belief that the parents of the state of Texas have a duty to raise their children. When we go to the parent-teacher conferences, we don't see members of the state of Texas there to check how our children are doing. We are looked to by the state to raise our minors to their majority. To do that, parents and guardians need to have access to information for their children. Now, if it pleases the court, the Texas Family Code, the Probate Code, when it defines minors, puts undivorced parents in de facto control of their children. It is only when there is a divorce action that it's necessary to look to 153.073 of the Texas Family Code that says both parents, both divorced parents, have equal rights to
information. But I don't think your opponent is arguing in any way, shape, or form that the Texas Family Code does not give the parents equal right. What he's arguing is that that doesn't have anything to do with the question before us, which is interpreting how to handle the confidentiality of mental health records under Chapter 611.
The reason it has something to do with this court is because Mr. Jones and Ms. Droxter are divorced, and that's the only reason.
Well, do they have greater rights than parents who are not divorced?
Pardon me?
Do they have greater rights than parents who are not divorced?
Absolutely not. They have the same equal right.
Well, then why does the Family Code have anything to do with what we're being asked to decide today?
Because as part of the proof to show Dr. Abrams that Mr. Jones was entitled to the records, as heretofore he may not have been prior to the passage of 153.073.
He would not have been as a non-divorced parent? I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
I believe you just said he would not have been entitled to them prior to the enactment of 153.
No, but prior to the enactment, a divorced parent that did not have those rights, powers, and privileges awarded to that parent in the decree would not have had the right of access to the records.
Well, I thought you just said that despite the Family Code statute that parents, whether divorced or not divorced, have that right.
I'm saying that prior to the time a parent is divorced, or people are divorced, they have equal rights of access to their children. Records, school records, hospital records, doctor's records. After the prior to the passage of 153.073, there was a question as to whether a non-primary parent, what we call possessory conservator, would have the same rights as the sole managing conservator to information about the children.
But when, aren't we talking about burden of proof here? I'm a little bit confused as to whether you're saying you've complied with 611 or you've complied with the Family Code. My understanding is under the Family Code, it's your position that they have to get a finding from the Family Code that it's not in the best interest of the child under the Family Code.
Before a parent is not entitled to the same access to rights, powers, privileges, and duties, excuse me, to information about a child that the other parent
has. Let's hone in on what parents are entitled to, parents who are not divorced. Assuming, as I think we all do, the Family Code puts a father who's divorced in the same shoes as a father who's not. A parent who comes into court and says, I want my records, I am acting on behalf of my child, what proof do they have to make to satisfy the on behalf of requirement of 611?
That under 611.004, subsection 4, that they are a parent of a minor patient. Once they show that, we go down, well, once we show that under 611.004, subsection 4, if they show that they are the parent of a minor or the guardian of an incompetent, a minor is an incompetent, or the personal representative of a deceased person, that the mental health care professional may disclose confidential information to them. Now, if you go to the next page, to 611.0045, and we read the points in the mental health care person's relationship with the patient when he may or may not be able to give access to the records. When you drop down to F, it says the content of a confidential record shall be made available to a person listed by section 611.004A4 or 5 who's acting on the patient's behalf. Now, by definition of 611.0044, a parent is acting on behalf of a minor.
I thought you conceded earlier in the argument that parents don't always act on behalf of a child just because they're the parent.
No, Justice, if you got that from my argument, I have confused what I'm saying. I can conceive situations where a parent may not act in his child's best interest.
Well, what if we put aside the best interest idea, and you have a parent who has been abusing their child? The child is in therapy and has the professional has won the confidence of the child, and the child is receiving help dealing with this circumstance. The parent comes in and wants those records for purposes of his or her own interest because they have been abusing the child. Now, we're not talking about in the best interest. We're talking about on the patient's behalf. Is that abusing parent seeking those records on the patient's behalf if what they want them for is for purposes of defending themselves or dealing with what they are concerned is going to happen to themselves?
Possibly, but that's going to be handled by a district court. Because
Before the district court can handle this, the statute has to be interpreted. And so what we're trying to get to the bottom of is what your position is on what on the patient's behalf means. In those circumstances, is that parent acting on the patient's behalf when he or she seeks records?
Yes.
How?
Because he or she is a parent of the child as defined by 611.044 is a person who can act on the behalf of the patient, just like a guardian of an incompetent or the personal representative of a deceased person would act on their behalf in dealing with the mental health care professional.
What would be the public policy argument?
In support of my position, that it would be...
All you have to do is show, demonstrate...
That because parents have such a high status
but
of responsibility...
You said we agree that parents obviously... children doesn't provide other ways summaries of this information about
sure.
the children.
Sure, that they can go and they can hire other mental health care experts. They can pay $200 an hour to some other psychiatrist to go down and have a conference. So now people have paid $200, $300, $400, $500, $600, $1,000 to determine whether parents have a right to see their children's records, which the statute, the 611 statute, not the family code statute, gives them a right to.
You said at some point a district court can get involved. Let me give you a hypothetical.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's suppose the parent comes in and all the parent shows is I am the parent, I want my minor's records. The doctor puts on a record and says I think this would be detrimental to the child and puts in evidence of why in that professional's opinion it would harm the child. All right. What do we do with that record? What is the district court permitted to do based on that record?
The district court at that point in time will make an inquiry into what's in the confidential records, will take a look at them, will have an in-camera viewing of them, and then will make a decision, just like Judge Montgomery did in this case, as to whether or not it is indeed somehow contrary to the child's best interest to release the records to the parent who has requested them.
Is there a finding to that effect in the record?
There are no findings of fact in the record because they weren't requested.
What evidence other than the records themselves is there that the release of these records will not be detrimental to the child?
The uncontroverted testimony in the record that the child did not mind the release of the records to her father, Mr. Jones, who I represent.
Does the child know what's in the records?
Pardon me?
Does the child know what is in the records?
One would presume so because she was there in conference with the psychologist when the records were being made. And the psychologist testified that it was because if she knew what was in the records that she, according to him, did not want them released. But there's uncontroverted testimony in the record that the child did not object to the records being released to Mr. Jones.
Other than the fact that it's been established that Mr. Jones is the father of the patient, what other evidence at all is there that Mr. Jones was acting on the patient's behalf?
By showing that under a valid decree of divorce in the state of Texas, that he had the rights guaranteed to a parent under 153.073 of the Texas Family Code, the right to the mental health care records at all times of his child, which were presented to Dr. Abrams and to the court.
There seems to be a bit of a disconnect here. I thought that the trial court ruled on a strict construction of the statute basis under 611.0045F shall be made available, and that the Court of Appeals decided the case on that basis, and that your position before this court was that that was correct. Now am I hearing the trial court took testimony, heard evidence, looked at the evidence in camera, and made a determination that, in fact, the doctor, he reviewed the doctor's records and determined that it would not be detrimental to the child to turn them over?
Of course, we don't know because there were no findings of facts or requests for conclusions of law filed. But we do know that we had an evidentiary hearing, that the court took the records and made an in-camera review of them and then issued its order sometime after that.
I'm confused. If, in fact, as you say, show that they're apparent, why then report from the record?
Because Dr. Abrams did not turn the records over.
Once your client demonstrates that, if, in fact,
I think it is, sir. Unless someone comes forward with a pleading to show some reason why, under this statute, the record should not be turned over.
Let me ask you, wait, stop right there. You said something that I had not heard before. Is it your position that if I come to a professional and say, I'm the parent, and that's a true fact, I'm the parent, the professional can turn over all these records and there's nothing, no further ramifications to the professional for having done so?
That's correct.
If I come to you and I say I'm a parent, and that's a true fact, and you're the professional, and you say I'm not going to turn over those records to you, then it's your position that we then jump down to the second part, and the professional is protected up to the point that a court then determines that there's a valid basis, or there's no valid basis for the professional to withhold it. But the professional could withhold that. But this whole issue doesn't come up to any significance unless the professional makes an initial decision to withhold it. And then the parent can't do anything but go to court and flesh out this other part.
If we're talking about the parent of a minor and the records are of a minor,
right?
Yes, I'm saying that when the parent goes and demonstrates that he's a parent of that minor or a guardian of the incompetent or the personal representative, and goes to the professional and makes a demand for the records, that at that point in time, the records should be given to him. If in 611.0045, there is decision by the professional that for some reason the records should not be turned over, then the balance of that statute comes into play, and a district court determines if there are good reasons why they should not be turned over. However, it is my belief under 611.045 that the legislature's use of the word shall in subsection F, if you please, compels the turnover to the parent, the guardian, or the personal representative unless a district court, upon review of that, finds some reason not to. What I want this court to see, there is a built-in safeguard for children's privacy. If there is some reason, as Justice Hankinson was talking about, that a parent should not see the records because they're trying to get the records to protect themselves from criminal prosecution, some type of liability, sure. The parent should not have those records. He'll get them anyway because when the case is filed against the parent over at the criminal courthouse, then the discovery comes in and he will see those records. But there is protection in place. That protection was utilized here, and after a review by the court was ordered that the records be turned over.
I'm not sure I understand the disagreement between you and opposing counsel then. From what I understand, you both read the statute the same way.
Well, I think we read the statute the same way. We come to a different conclusion about how it should be applied. I suggest to the court that under subsection F, that when the legislature says shall be made available, that it means simply that. I also suggest that under this statute that a professional has the ability to go to a district court and attempt to, for some reason, not turn those records over.
He says it comes down to burden of proof. That he didn't
yes,
have,
sir.
He didn't have to say a word. All he had to do was sit there, and you had the burden, and you say he has some burden to make a showing why he shouldn't have to get it.
Why he should not. That's correct, Justice Hatt.
And in any event, both of you claim to have put on evidence, and the trial court looked at the record.
That's correct, sir.
So this is an evidentiary review and not a statutory interpretation?
That's correct. Any other questions?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
In answer to your question, Justice O'Neill, we have preserved the evidentiary point from day one, because the only evidence in this record is the evidence from Dr. Abrams that it was not in the child's best interest, and he explained why.
And what about the statement that there was
even though
I heard counsel say the daughter said it was okay.
I'm sorry.
I think I heard your opposing counsel say it was okay with the daughter, and there was
Well, I think you need to look at the record. I think we objected to that on the basis of hearsay. I think it was sustained. Mr. Jones didn't make that statement, but I believe it was objected to, and I believe the objection was sustained because it was hearsay.
But doesn't the trial judge have some power by making an in-camera inspection of the records to make this determination?
Judge, there's no question about that, but this trial court did not try this case under 611. That's the problem.
The trial court said that the trial court had the power to decide it.
He did, but he decided under 157. And because he was a family district court judge, and he decided under 157. That's part of the problem we have here, because the burden of proof was reversed. I put my case on it in abundance of caution, and I welcome you all to read the transcript. It's a very short transcript, and look at the evidence.
Well, yep. I'm a little confused. If he tried the case under the family code, but you objected to it and said it really ought to be 611, and now we get to this court, and all we're talking about is 611, which the trial court rejected. Is that what your real point is? He should have done 611, and when you do that, here we are?
Judge, I don't think there's any question it should be tried under 611. That's our whole case.
Well, why is it that the family code 153073 doesn't apply?
Well, because, first of all, it creates if you read the legislative intent was to put all conservators on the same level. That's why the statute was passed. What the respondent is saying is
there's this discussion. Well, when you're in a conservator position, you're not a, quote, ordinary parent, close quote. So now we have to do something to equalize and balance conservators' rights,
which sounds
like a simple plan. So all this is saying is that if you're a conservator, each one has the same rights. So what difference is there now between ordinary parents and conservator parents?
Well, only that one has come under the jurisdiction of the family code by virtue of some domestic upheaval.
Well, I understand it, but they're still parents.
That's right, Judge. And this
scheme was to resolve disputes between divorced parents on who gets what and why and when, wasn't it?
Correct.
And this basically says, well, you get the same thing you had as if you were still married. And then the family code says, if you're one of these parents, you get access to the records, period. Why doesn't that control over this, what seems to be?
Because I don't think that the family code can conflict with the obvious intent of the legislature to protect these records. What that means is that they have equal access.
What about a policy argument? There's obviously policy reason to protect the confidentiality of professional records in areas like this.
Correct.
But there's also an obvious public policy, as articulated by opposing counsel, that parents have the duty and obligation to raise their children and that they should have access to records that would assist in that. Why doesn't that public policy interact with what we have here and we make a decision?
Because the legislature has always treated mental health professionals and mental health in a wholly different way, because it's a special area. And that's why it's a weighing process. And the legislature has chosen to give mental health professionals discretion, and that's what they do. There's a brand new statute that's just been passed. It's the abortion information statute. There's an obvious example where the legislature knew there's going to be a conflict between parent and children.
Without getting into that, let me ask you, follow through with Mr. Brown's argument. If I understand it correctly today, this case was tried under 611. Well, follow me through. It was tried under 611. The trial court, the professional came forward with testimony that it would be detrimental to the child to release this information. The trial court reviewed it in camera and came out and determined that was not so. If that is in fact the case, are we to then do a no evidence report?
Well, Judge, that's been preserved by my brief, because there is no evidence as far as that there was anything on behalf of the child. But what I'm asking you to do, and I think it's very, very important, is to not put a period after the word five here, or after the number five, because that's what the respondent is doing, and that's what the court is doing.
But let's assume you're right, and you say it, under 157 the parent has the burden, and under 611 the mental health professional is right. Did I get that?
No, Judge, I'm not saying it. I'm saying 157. Judge Hankinson was absolutely correct. The family code has nothing to do with this case.
I thought you said that the burdens of proof were different. But let's set
I'm sorry, Judge. I did because of the way this was tried at the court level.
But who has the burden under 611?
Under 611, the mental health professional has the burden.
All right, if you
under 611-1005, which is that's the statute number.
If you had the burden in this case and the error was that the trial court thought it was under 157 where the other side had the burden, that would seem to me to redound to your benefit, isn't it?
I think that's probably correct, but it's such a – and understand that we brought this case up on appeal, Judge, when nobody except myself had any idea that 611 existed.
You keep arguing 611, but Dr. Abrams didn't file a written statement or give a written statement to the parent as required by 611. So what do we do about that?
Well, Judge, I think Dr. Abrams should have done it. If you read the records, it says that he informed them verbally about why he wasn't doing it. But I think he should have done it.
What's the consequence, though, under the statute, when the statute says the mental health professional shall provide a written statement? What's the consequence?
Well, had Mr. Jones pled and prove a 611-005 case, perhaps the court would have chastised Dr. Abrams for not doing that. But the important thing is that they knew they weren't getting the records and they knew the reason that they weren't getting the records. And not that they weren't getting information about their child. They were not getting the specific records. This court can think of multiple examples where it would be improper for a parent to have records. You also can think of multiple examples where it would be improper for a person to get the records if that is taken out of the statute. And just one quick example of that.
On our time now.
Two quick questions.
Okay.
You just stated that it's your position that it is the doctor's burden of proof under 611.
That's what the statute says.
All right. Does that mean that it's the doctor's burden to prove that the father is not acting on the patient's behalf?
Well, I think it's a mixed burden. I think what the doctor has to prove is why he's denying access to the records under 611-0045B.
Let me ask you this. What evidence is there in the record that the father was not acting on the patient's behalf?
There is no evidence in the record whatsoever about that issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause, and the argument in all the causes submitted here is now complete. Marshall will adjourn the court.